Thank you, Chris. It's a delight. I've been wanting to do something like this for quite a while, and Chris and I have talked about it. As Chris said, I've known him for a number of years, and so it's a delight that Good News here has invited me to be able to teach this class. And before we actually start into the material, a few things that we're going to be doing. As Chris mentioned, we're videotaping this tonight, and my friend Kirk Phillips is the one you can thank for running behind the camera back there. We play in band together, and so he has done quite a bit of videotaping, and he was just most gracious to say he would do this for us. So this is we hope to send this out on YouTube or wherever these things always go sometimes. So because I've had several other requests from other churches to say, oh, or people say, well, I'd love to be there, but I can't be there for all of them. So this is a good opportunity. Before we jump into the material, you'll probably notice, let me just talk briefly about this little bibliography that I put here. You'll notice I have it broken down into really big books, and I couldn't resist putting big letters with really big books. Sorry about the joke. Medium-sized books and more normal-sized, smaller books. These are all survey books of the history of American Christianity. I've attached some notes to them so that you can say, and I've got copies of all of them right back over there. So if you look at them. And there's no assignments, obviously, in this class, but if you are interested, got the time, and say, I would like to read something along. They range from 250 pages to the really big ones that were over, the two of them that are over 1,200 pages, weighing in at about 15 pounds apiece. And if you read both of those, you can help come co-teach the class with me, because they are very big books. The editions that I have over there are not always the latest, because I didn't own the latest, or the library, university library where I got some of them doesn't have the latest. Some of them have been through, I just discovered when I was putting these together that Hudson and Corrigan is now in its ninth edition, 2018. And it started out in 1965 with Winthrop Hudson, who's been deceased for many years, and it's now far more John Corrigan than Winthrop Hudson, but it still gets used as a textbook. So I have a description here. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about any of these books. And what we're also going to be doing is giving you a set of notes, note papers, that will correspond with the PowerPoint so that you can write things down. The format that I have in mind is that I will talk in kind of a lecture format. If something is really unclear, don't hesitate to raise your hand. And if you want a clarification question, you know, what did you mean? I didn't quite get that. I'll try to write a few things on the whiteboard. But we will spend some time, hopefully about 15 minutes at the end, for general questions. We'll probably turn the video camera off then, so you don't feel like you have questions that are going out into cyberspace someplace for some. For example, a good friend of mine goes to a church on Washington Island in Door County, Wisconsin, and he's already asked me if he can have this class. So some of you think, I don't want my questions going out to a church in Door County, Wisconsin. But so we won't do that. But we'll try to allow some time for some Q&A at the end. And I used to say there's no such thing as a dumb question. When I taught at Kirkwood, I did one time have a student that asked one question, and it was the question that was essentially the first line of the syllabus, and this was the second time she had taken the course. She had not done very well the first time, and I thought, yes, Becky did ask a dumb question, because it was literally verbatim what the first line of the syllabus said. But most questions, 99% of the questions, are not dumb questions. They're good questions that you may need some clarification on. So let me just hand this off to Mike back here. Maybe he can pass, because we're going to make a few more copies of this, of the book list as well. All right. So, history of American Christianity. That's what this course is about. So we're picking it up at the start of our country. Obviously, church history goes a long way beyond that. The United States. We celebrate the Pilgrim Fathers, Jamestown, 1607, 1620. There's 1,600 years of church history before that. So immediately, we are thrown back into European church history as the background for our American situation. And matter of fact, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the background in England, because while there were other countries that sent immigrants in colonial days, and we will briefly talk about some of them, they came into an English context. The English were essentially provided the context for our American history, And so we need to be able to understand the English context, how it flows into the American context, and what it does. Now, there are lots of different ways that you can study American religious history. We're going to be taking what was really the standard approach, and which is why these textbooks basically follow this approach for many years. And it was, I think it's still the best approach, and I think it will best fit what you're interested in. That's to see that there's a main trunk that flows out of the Puritan version of evangelical Protestantism, gets transmogrified somewhat in the 19th century with revivalism, other issues, and flows into as the dominant mainstream until about 1900. And then it fights like the Dickens because it's no longer the mainstream anymore. And that is still, I think, the best way to tell the story, and it's also the best way for you because it's probably the one that you're most interested in. There are other ways you could do it. There are some very valuable ways. For example, there are good histories of history of the influence of the Bible in America. Yeah, very good way of looking at slicing it. It's another way to slice the material. And we will touch on some of that, but that gets us off into some other issues. There are newer approaches that now, and to the very end when I was teaching at Kirkwood, I was getting these sample textbooks from publishers, noticing how, with the rise of diversity, we were getting all of these books that what I'm calling the mainstream got one chapter. And what you got were chapters on Buddhists in America and Muslims in America and Elvis as religious figure in America. I kid you not. There was a book that had a chapter in it on Elvis as religious figure in America. You know, yeah, it's a legitimate question to ask. How is Elvis a religious figure in America? But a whole chapter on Elvis as religious figure in America. You begin saying, I think somebody's missing the mainstream for a little side eddy over here. And so we're going to go with this mainstream. So, what are our goals going to be? He said the pointer. Okay. Richard, are we not right there? Okay. It was working a minute ago. Can you click the next one, Richard? And yeah, here we go. I don't know. We'll try it again and see if we're... Oh, there we... Now we're working again.
Yes, it's a side arrow.
Okay. Goals for the class. What are we going to try to accomplish in this class? And by the way, these first few PowerPoints, I'm not expecting you to try to take notes on this or anything. This is just so we have some understanding where we're going. Remembering that history is God's work among us. Why do we study history? Why do we study church history? Why do we study American church history? Because it's God's work among us. The history of what God has done through his church and the American people ought to interest us. It's what God has done among us. Greater understanding of where we came from. You know, I'm reminded of Peanuts cartoon. You remember Peanuts, the famous Peanuts cartoons? There was a great cartoon on church history, and I think it was Charlie Brown who started, he said, I'm studying church history. And I think it was Lucy who was writing a little paper, and she said, church history, Pastor Brown was born in. In other words, her notion of church history was whenever the pastor of their church was born. Well, obviously, we got a lot more that we need to know so we can understand where we came from. Number three, dispelling some commonly held myths about our American religious history, and there are some that people have. Let me just give you one example. When you get into the question of the influence on were the founding fathers Christians, I've seen really extreme positions on both sides of the coin that have been advocated. One is they were all card-carrying evangelical Christians. The other hand, that they were all secular deists. Neither one of those are accurate. And the whole situation is far more muddied than that. Actually, it's a great example, that one, that history is always muddier than we want it to be. And so that's one of the things we will learn. Number four, helping us to understand our forebears on their own terms and not being captive to presentism. I don't know if that's a term anybody else uses, but it's my term. What's presentism? That's saying that the way things are today must be the way they were exactly 200 years ago, 300 years ago, 400 years ago. They're not. And we will learn, even tonight, as we go over some of the material, we'll begin seeing a few minor differences that will be important for us to understand where we come from. Number five. In other words, understanding that there's a great continuity between the forms of historic Orthodox evangelical Protestantism in our history, but considerable diversity. Orthodox, what we're meaning here is those who hold to the core doctrines of the historic Christian faith, the doctrine of the Trinity, doctrine of the deity of Christ, held in common by all the main bodies of historic Christianity. And evangelical, we will learn what that means in greater detail, but we're really talking about a gospel-centered, with Christ and his gospel at the center, flowing out of the Protestant Reformation. But there's diversity. And understanding the mainstream, our sixth point, that goal, and how the offshoots fit in relationship. I'll give you one notable example. Many of us are familiar with Mormonism as a religious group. Mormonism is impossible to understand unless you understand it is a reaction against revivalism in upstate New York in the 1820s when Joseph Smith said there were all these churches, the Baptists were having a revival, the Methodists were having a revival, the Presbyterians were having a revival, and each church was saying, yep, the revival means you should join our church. And he went off in the woods and prayed and said God told him none of the churches were right, so he should start his own. You can't understand Mormonism unless you understand he's reacting against a culture of revivalism and a culture that where different churches were having revivals in their church, but each one was saying, "But yeah, but ours is the purest revival, so you should come to our church." So he's reacting against that. So this is helpful to understand when we look at it. And if you know the history of Mormonism, and we'll spend a brief time talking about it when it comes up, you know that it goes off in some really strange directions. But every one of those directions is a reaction against what the mainstream of evangelical Protestantism was doing. It's important to see that. Okay. Now, before we go into a lot of specifics, let's look at some characteristics of early American Christianity. These are general characteristics that we're going to find. And these are characteristics, I'm using the American Revolution as kind of a basic model from the colonial days to the American Revolution, colonial America, shall we say. What were characteristics of it? The denominations that are most popular today were either non-existent or tiny at the time of the American Revolution. That's the truth. Denominations that are most popular today were either tiny or non-existent at the time of the American Revolution. Largest denominations were in this order: Congregationalists. Now you have to just stop and think, yeah, there's a Congregational church, First Congregational in downtown Iowa City, but we got one in Iowa City. Virtually all of the small towns in Iowa do not have a Congregational church. There's an occasional one. It was the largest denomination in colonial America. Presbyterians were number two. Baptists, a relatively distant third. And Anglicans or Episcopalians, you have to remember that Anglicans is simply the term for Church of England. They changed the name to Episcopalian when we got our independence because it didn't sound right to say we were the Church of England when you just declared yourself independent. So they renamed themselves the Protestant Episcopal Church of America. Okay. Baptists, though, had only surged in the last two decades before the American Revolution. So the in that order, even though Baptists are number three, they're Johnny-come-lately number threes in that list. Now, you should notice some conspicuous by absence. That's our third point. Methodists, Lutherans, and Roman Catholics were a tiny percentage of churches. Now, here in the Midwest, Iowa, how many towns don't have a Methodist, a Lutheran, or a Roman Catholic church? We got them everywhere. They were tiny in colonial America. 1% Roman Catholic in our colonies. And most of those were in Maryland, which was purposely designed to be a haven for Roman Catholics. Five Methodist preachers with 65 preaching stations, that's a small number. Now, the Methodists would explode after the turn of the 19th century, but there are hardly any Methodists. Lutherans, 150 churches, mostly in Pennsylvania. They were mostly German and Swedish immigrants. And they were concentrated, for the most part, in the state of Pennsylvania. Five Jewish synagogues. That's all there were in colonial America, no Pentecostals, and many other groups that had not seen the light of day yet. And we'll go on there. We can go on and on about some of this. We will learn about some of them. So, this is important to see. This is the big picture of what characteristics of Barr's number of churches. Now, we've got a few more things we want to say. What was common among them? The overwhelming number of them, what were they? Calvinistic. And overwhelmingly so. Now, I know you guys are studying in your one of your Sunday school classes, J.I. Packer's works. J.I. Packer is a classic Reformed theologian, or a Calvinist theologian. Most of them, the overwhelming, except for the Baptist, baptized infants. This was common. The Baptists were number three, but they were a distant third. And when you add in remember that ranking? When you add in the Lutherans, the Dutch Reformed, the German Reformed, the French Reformed, you probably got 85 to 90% of the evangelical Protestants. I'm not talking about liberal high church Protestants. I'm talking about evangelical Protestants practiced pedobaptism. They practiced strict Sabbatarian views. Sunday was kept as a strict Sabbath. And that meant that they had worship in the morning, generally worship in the afternoon. You didn't cook any meals. You ate cold food because cooking a meal was working that they didn't want the women to do. The Sabbath generally started the evening before. They practiced a sundown to sundown Sabbath. And they actually, in much of colonial New England, they had strict rules. Sabbath breaking was one of the reasons people were brought before the civil magistrates almost more than any other crime in colonial New England. And there were fines for it, big ones sometimes. So they were strict Sabbatarians. They sang only a cappella psalms in worship. You would hardly find an organ, let alone or a piano, or any other instrument in any church in colonial America, because that was associated for the most part with papists and Romanists, which is their favorite term for Roman Catholics. The papists and the Romanists used organs, and they did not find them organs in the New Testament, or pianos for that matter. Pianos weren't really around very much, but organs were some, so they sang a cappella psalms. The first book published in America was the Bay, what? Psalm book, and it was a group of metrical psalms. That's what they sang. Many of them to the classic Geneva tune. If you're familiar with any Geneva psalm tune, when you sing the doxology, that's technically, if you look at the tune name of that is Old Hundredth. That was the tune written by Louis Bourgeois, Calvin's psalm hymn writer, or tune writer, I should say, and they sang that to the 100th psalm, rather than the more well-known today doxology. All creatures, and it was clearly a psalm tune. And the last one up there, they had no qualms about moderate alcohol consumption. The Puritans regularly came over with their daily rations of alcohol, and this may surprise you, and I have this from a good authority and a friend of mine who's an expert in colonial American history, that Isaac Backus, who is the Baptist hero of the colonial time, regularly ordered kegs of beer for all the Baptist social functions at his church. Now, if you know anything about Ballard Baptists today, you know most of them are not likely to, not only to moderately drink alcohol, but the thought of having kegs of beer at your church function. If you had a church potluck, you brought a keg of beer in. Now, that gives you, just those things alone ought to tell you that this is what we call presentism. When we read back what we have today and think, oh, they must have been like us. Well, I suspect that there are already several things in there that you're saying, that's not exactly us. That's not exactly us. That's not exactly us. Bible-believing, serious Christians, that's what they were like. We need to understand that. The fifth one is an important one. Many had no qualms about an established church. You might say, what's an established church? Best way to put this is the state pays the ministers and you pay taxes, so the minister gets paid. They had an established church in England, the Church of England, but guess what? When the Puritan Congregationalists especially came to New England, guess what they did? They made the Congregational Church the established church. The few people in New England who were not Congregationalists, the Baptists and the Anglicans, that this was a really strange reversal. The Anglicans were the non-established church in Puritan New England. But this is what may surprise people. Connecticut had an established Congregational Church until 1816, and Massachusetts had an established Congregational Church until 1833. Now, think about that. How much longer after the American Revolution that was? We're talking about 60 years in Massachusetts. Your taxes went to pay for the Congregational Church minister. And if you were a dissenter, which was the name for a non-Congregationalist, now they had Anglican establishments in New York, New Jersey, South Carolina, North Carolina. So other states, the Anglicans established their church. And the big hassle was, especially that worked out, was in Virginia, which had an established Anglican church, but had lots of Baptists and Presbyterians in the backcountry. And the Baptists and Presbyterians got together and didn't like it. You know, they didn't like paying taxes just for the Anglican rector, who, in their opinion, was more interested sometimes in horse racing and other things than he was in providing spiritual care. And the parishes were huge, you know, up and down, sometimes 40, 50 miles long, up and down the James and the York and those other rivers. So this would become a big issue in early American church history, and is part of the background is why the United States eventually adopted separation of church and state. But you have to understand, many of them, let me give you an example. Patrick Henry, most of you are familiar with Patrick, you know, the give me liberty or give me death guy. Do you know, he was an evangelical Anglican. He to the day he died, he argued for an established Episcopal church in Virginia. He could say, give me liberty or give me death, but boy, he wanted the taxes for his church paid by the state. So, you're thinking, huh? Paying taxes for a certain denomination? I'm not of that denomination. It was the most common one. Now, American, I think I bumped that accidentally. Now, the ninth, here we go. Let's go back here. Number six, while small groups were used, there was almost no lay participation in worship. This is interesting, is that in Puritanism in particular, small groups of laymen were very important. Matter of fact, in the history of Puritanism, the work of small groups of Puritan laymen probably played a huge role. And when you read the history of this material, it's funny because they talk about in England, and then eventually many of these people came to the United States. They were people that got reputations about gadding about for sermons, which is a way of saying they were so interested in their spiritual life that they would go from one minister to another. And that's how they got themselves in trouble, because they didn't want to go to their established church that they were supposed to be at. But instead, they would go over to some neighboring parish. They liked the pastor there better. And then they would bring home copies of his sermon, and they would gather small groups in their home and discuss them. And they got themselves in trouble a lot of times. So small groups of laymen played a huge role. But in the church itself, Richard, we've lost this again here, just a second. Here we go. Thank you. In the church itself, in worship, there was virtually no lay participation. It was absolutely ministerially dominated. From the beginning of the call to worship to the benediction at the end, you would have not seen any lay participation. And one of the tussles in American Puritanism that has its roots in English Puritanism is, what's the role of the clergy and what's the role of the laity? As I already said, laity played a big role in encouraging Puritanism and encouraging the spirituality connected with it. But the ministers liked that to a certain extent, but were always a bit nervous because they saw it to go, in their minds, crazy sometimes. And it did go crazy sometimes. You get into the 1650s when they had the levelers who wanted to get rid of all social distinctions, the fifth millennial people who were sure that the second coming was right around the corner, and so they should all sort of stand on the corner and wait for it. And what were these? These were popular lay driven, and the ministers were scared to death of some of that. So there's this tension between a very lay driven movement and what can the ministers do to make sure it doesn't go crazy? And this would be an important part of it. Number seven, even in churches with minimal liturgy, worship would have been, on the whole, more formal. The minister would always have been in a robe. Now, it's hard for us to think in terms of a Baptist minister in a robe, but in colonial America, Baptist ministers wore black robes. Now, didn't mean that they always wanted all the other trappings. As a matter of fact, one of the big debates in early Puritanism is when the English queen told them through her archbishop, that would be Queen Elizabeth, that they had to wear the surplice, which is this white thing that went over the top of their robes. And it called the vestment controversy because the English Puritan ministers said, we ain't wearing that, basically. Over my dead body am I wearing. That's popish. That's Romanist. That's Catholic. I'm not wearing that white thing. Plain black robes. That's all we do is plain black robes. You know, and because a plain black robe was an academic gown, and it was seen as lovely. This was seen as non-pretentious to wear a robe because nobody could look at your clothes then. You had a black robe on, plain black robe. And they didn't like it when the Queen of England told them they had to wear this white surplice thing. It was a little white semi-shawl that went over the top. And so they didn't like it. So, and it was a big deal. There were people who basically almost got booted out of their churches because they wouldn't wear that. But they all were in robes. And worship would have been more formal. And this is important too. They often used different terminology than we would use today. For example, they would have said that someone was converted or entered into covenant with Christ or had an interest in Christ, but rarely would they say someone had been saved. They might have looked at you like famous Bishop Lightfoot was supposedly have said when the little lady from the rescue mission stopped him in 19th century England and said, sir, have you been saved? And he responded, I have been saved, I'm being saved, and I will be saved. And he was absolutely technically correct. Because salvation includes justification, sanctification, and glorification. And so to be saved, that was nonsense to them to say you have been saved. I have been converted. I've been justified, yes, but saved. But how much isn't that part of our evangelical terminology today? So-and-so got saved. They would have looked at you and said, wait a minute. No, salvation isn't done. They're not are they glorified? Are they still here? Yeah, well, then they're not fully saved yet. You're only fully saved when you die, when you're glorified. So the terminology was different. Because they saw salvation including a whole range of steps, regeneration, conversion, justification, sanctification, and glorification. And most were post or amillennial in their eschatology. And if you happen to have read such things as the Scofield Bible, you read Hal Lindsey books, Left Behind novels, you know what? If you would have showed it to them, they would have not only not believed it, it would have been absolutely bewilderingly bizarre to them. They would have said, what is this? I've never heard of such a thing. If you'd talked about the rapture, they would have said, never heard of that. What are you talking about? What is that? I've never heard of that thing. So their whole approach, they were very interested in end times. Many of them were sure that when they moved to America, the millennium was just around the corner, but they thought in post-millennial terms. Their moving to America, many of them thought, was going to bring the millennium here. And that was very crucial for them. And number 10, yet the stage was set for the remarkable diversity to come. Let me just talk a little bit about the diversity of American Christianity. I just got these out of Wikipedia. I know you got to watch Wikipedia. Everybody says anybody can put anything in there, but it was the most convenient source to get the most up-to-date figures I could get. And I picked the four prominent groups in America, religious groups. According to Wikipedia, there are 25 different Baptist groups in America today. I think they way underestimated. I'm sure there's more. 27 different Presbyterians. They're probably right about that. 15 different Methodist groups. Methodists are always love organizations, so they don't let them splinter as much. And 34, that should be Lutheran. 34 different Lutheran groups. 34 Lutheran groups. Now, some of those are very interesting. Some of you probably have never heard of the Duck River Kindred Baptist Association, have you, under Baptists? You never heard of the Duck River? Well, it has about five churches, and it's down in Appalachia someplace. Now, my own Presbyterian denomination, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, let me ask you, how many of you had heard of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church before today? Three or four of you. Not very many of you. It's a small Presbyterian denomination, started in 1936, but it's one of the 27 Methodist groups. You probably didn't know there were primitive Methodists, evangelical Methodists, there's a whole bunch of different kinds, Bible Methodists. There's all kinds of different kinds of Methodist groups, Wesleyan Methodists. There are all kinds of groups in the Methodists. Lutherans, there's the Church of the Lutheran Reformation, besides the more well-known ELCA Lutherans, the Missouri Synod and Wisconsin Synod Lutherans, is the Lutheran Brethren, which are low church Lutherans. They don't have a liturgy, unlike most. Their service is going to be very similar to you have here, but they have Lutheran doctrine. So there's a whole variety of different groups. Now, that is simply the main groups. And you realize that there are a whole lot of other ones. Now, my favorite one that I found recently, and I used to have a book called Small Sects, S-E-C-T-S, in America. And it had most fascinating groups in there, but I somehow, over the years, lost that book. But I have another book here called The Religious Bodies of America. And this is the one that I thought would be the best, most interesting example to give you the name. The National David Spiritual Temple of Christ Church Union, Incorporated of the USA. That is actually a religious group in the United States. I'll repeat that again. The National David Spiritual Temple of Christ Church Union, Incorporated, they have that in parentheses, of the USA. Now, I could not find anything hardly about it except one thing. They must have some strange doctrine of the Trinity, because it's one of the groups that the Roman Catholic Church does not accept their view of the Trinity as, so their baptism isn't valid. You know, Roman Catholics will accept everybody else's baptism. They would accept a baptism done here in your church, a baptism in Orthodox Presbyterian, because it's done in the name of the triune God. But they don't accept that group's baptism. So what that group believes, I don't know, but it's there. Now, when I was a pastor in my first church in Decatur, Illinois, my favorite one was there were two churches. There was that, and the ministers came to our ministers' fellowship, and this was the name of the two local churches. There was Church of the Living God, Pillar and Ground of the Truth, Temple Number 1. And then there was Church of the Living God, Pillar and Ground of the Truth, Temple Number 2. And Bishop Eddie Morgan was with Temple Number 1. I can't remember who was at Temple Number 2. But I always wondered, how do you write that on your check? You know, Church of the Living God, Pillar and Ground of the Truth. I suppose you have to do a lot of abbreviation to get your name in that check when you're doing your donation to the church. But we obviously have huge numbers of diversity. So American Christianity has gone from, you know, a certain modest body in colonial days to huge. Some of it is because we've had ethnic groups that have come here. Churches have started ethnic. Under the Baptist groups, among those are churches that have a Swedish and German Baptist roots. And those denominations are still in existence today. There were other groups, and we haven't even picked up on the Dutch and German Reformed, and most of the Lutherans were originally ethnic groups. They had the hardest time because all the various Lutherans would start their own synods, and some of the groups had disagreements. I mean, the most interesting one to me was always the Danish Lutherans, because in Denmark they'd been having some debates, and when they came to the United States, they took their debates with them and then made them even bigger. And every Danish community in America, we have lots of them in western Iowa, up by Elkhorn out there in eastern Nebraska, has lots of them. And they used to joke that every Danish community had two Lutheran churches. One they called them the Holy Danes, and the other one they called the Happy Danes, because one church was stricter than the other one, and they disagreed. And they had their own separate synods. And so some of it has to do with churches would bring their groups. Now, you probably didn't realize among Presbyterians there are groups that no longer exist, but among my favorites among Presbyterians, when the Scots had some of their squabbles and brought them over, they brought them over here. And for a while we had Burger Associate Presbyterians and Anti-Burger Associate Presbyterians. You might say, what in the world is that? Well, it was a squabble over whether you took the oath of office in Scotland, the Burger Oath. That meant that you were a magistrate in the local community. And some of them opposed the oath. They said it was not a good oath. It was an oath that made you say blasphemous things. And others said, yeah, we can take the oath. Well, they immigrated to the United States, and it took them years before they figured out that the issue of the Burger Oath and the Anti-Burger Oath were a moot point in the United States, because we didn't have Burger Oaths like they had in the U.S. and Scotland. So we imported in the U.S. lots of things from Europe, all kinds of interesting sorts of things. Now, really, there were denominations called the Anti-Burger Associate. The associate was important because they even split off They called it the associate presbytery because they split off from the main body of Presbyterians. And then they split again into the burgers and anti-burgers. They brought them here. So we have this welter, huge number of groups. And we aren't going to obviously talk about most of them. But you just need to realize that there's this huge number in the United States. And I said, and a cast of thousands of other denominations, independent churches of all sorts. Now we're going to get into the material proper, shall we say, where we're going to start using some of your notes, where we will begin talking about the Protestant Reformation background. As we said, we have to back up and to go back to Europe to understand the folks who've come here. Protestant Reformation. We have key figures, Luther, who was a more cautious reformer in most ways. Then we have Zwingli and Calvin in the Reformed tradition. Got this term, Reformed. And it's a term that is used widely in theological circles. You'll find it gets used differently in various circles. And so we're going to have to do a little bit of defining here. For Lutherans, generally they use the term Reformed to mean any non-Lutheran, which drives those of us who are genuinely Reformed, which I am, kind of goofy, because we say that's not a good definition. But I've read Lutheran theology after Lutheran theology. Well, all of those Reformed people, that means anybody who's non-Lutheran and still an Orthodox Christian, is Reformed. Then you have Reformed confessionalists, and that means defined by the historic Reformed confessions, Belgic Confession, French Reformed Confession, the Westminster Confession of Faith. I happen to like that definition of his Reformed, and it's helpful for us, I think. But it's not always the way everybody uses it. Then there's another definition sometimes, those who believe in Calvinistic views of salvation. Hopefully you can all read this. Calvinistic views of salvation. And obviously there's a lot of overlap between these two, but they're not identical. Lots of Baptists would have Calvinistic views of salvation, for example. Historically, most Baptists do, but they don't agree on all the doctrines of the Reformed confessions. But what was key of the Reformed tradition? The founders were Zwingli and Calvin, but unlike Lutheranism, it wasn't just one leader. There were a whole series of them. There was Bullinger in Switzerland, Martin Bucer on the French-German border, Oecolampadius. Yes, there was a guy whose name was Oecolampadius. That was his name. And a whole series, Peter Martyr Vermigli, and just a whole bunch of reformers that were in the Reformed tradition. And what they generally did was thought that Luther was a bit timid in his Reformation. And in other words, they thought Luther was not quite willing to go far enough in what he was doing. So, a good example, the war on idolatry. There was a famous historian that taught at the University of Virginia named Carlos Eyre, E-I-R-E, that wrote a famous book called The War on Idolatry. And he said if you had to define what the Reformed tradition at its heart was all about, it was this. They wanted to smash the idols. In other words, they thought that worship in the Reform, in the churches, was not pure. And they wanted to do that. Now, I was going to play this later, but Richard, I think we'll play, if we can now, that little video clip. And this is set in Puritan New England, and it gives you a good example of what I'm talking about here. This is from the movie Oliver Cromwell and has Richard Harris. Surplus, by the way.
And we, thy humble servants, grant us the spirit of thy grace through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Who has done this? Okay. Answer me. Who has done this?
An edict, squire, from the archbishop himself, and by order of the king.
By order of the king? Is the Church of England not a Protestant church? Would the king turn the house of God into a Roman temple?
Mr. Cromwell, I beseech you.
Does the king think that God can be bought with gold, trinkets, and gilded rubbish?
I know only that I have been instructed.
Has this king forgotten the Reformation?
Mr. Cromwell,
away with it. Popish, idolatry!
That is a good example of what Carlos Iyer said when he talked about the war on idolatry. The whole notion that the church should be reformed in worship was crucial for the Reformed tradition. And Zwingli in Zurich probably took it as far as anybody when he whitewashed all the walls, replaced all the stained glass windows with clear glass, had some people come and smash the organ in the cathedral in Zurich to pieces because he said that was popish, and they sang nothing again but psalms. And it got to the point where some people criticized the Reformed tradition as nothing being nothing but four square walls, some psalms, and a sermon, because they were very concerned about purity of worship. Now, you notice that that video clip that we shot was in Puritan England. And one of the key things that we're going to see is that will come into the English Puritan tradition is the Church of England was a Protestant church, but in the mind of many of the people, it was an impure Protestant church because it had retained too many popish. Did you catch that in the video? And that's why he was up there knocking all the gold things off the altar up the front, getting mad at the wimpy minister. Because remember he said it was the king's edict, right? Does one go against the edict of the king? And so this would become a really key issue. And the goal here, the issue that comes up here, is that since the churches in the Reformed tradition emphasized this purity in worship so much more. Now, this doesn't mean that there was no structure to the service. They clearly had a structure to the service. There was a call to worship. There was a confession of sin. There were like two or three Bible readings. There were psalms that were sung. There was usually one of the Bible readings was an annotated Bible reading, which is sort of like a mini sermon. And then they usually had a long hour long. Most Puritan ministers preached at least an hour if you weren't worth your salt, if you couldn't preach an hour. And they didn't want to call you unless you could preach an hour in most of the old Reformed churches. My own Dutch Reformed forebears that had that same thing when they immigrated to the United States, because they said, why would you want to call somebody if you can't preach for at least an hour? You're not getting your money's worth out of that guy. So it was very heavy sermon-oriented, and with the Psalms, but it had a structure, but there was a downplaying of anything that smacked in their mind of papistry or Romanism. And so that's a crucial thing. Now, we're going to just go over this quickly. Most of you are familiar with the five solas. I know that you've done a series here on the five solas. But these are the doctrinal core of the Protestant Reformation. And the Reformed tradition would clearly carry that forward very well. sola scriptura. Matter of fact, the Protestant tradition would argue, the Reformed tradition, branch of the Protestant tradition, would argue that they carried sola scriptura more faithfully than the Lutheran branch did, because they were only would use in worship and in doctrine, and these were the two caveats. This is spelled out in the Westminster Confession very carefully. Either what was explicitly said or by good and necessary consequences. In other words, they were quite willing to say that some things, the Trinity, for example, is not explicitly spelled out in Scripture, but by good and necessary consequences, it is taught there. And they deduced several other things. Their view of infant baptism, for example, was clearly deduced by what they felt were good and necessary consequences from the Scripture. Yeah, they knew it wasn't explicitly there, but they said good and necessary consequences led to that doctrine. So sola scriptura, sola gratia, by grace alone. And the Reformed tradition would argue that it emphasized grace alone. They said God begins salvation. They would take it all the way back to eternity past with God's election. And they said unless you believe God elects unconditionally, calls unconditionally, that salvation is the work of God's grace totally, you really don't believe in sola gratia, grace alone. They said that any emphasis on human will detracts from grace alone. That's what they're going to emphasize. Grace, unmerited favor. Sola fide, it's received by faith alone. Trust in the promises of God so that works, good works, do not contribute to our right standing with God. Rather, trust in what God has done. Faith is not considered a good work. It is trust in Christ who is outside of our good works. Solus Christus, Christ alone. They talked about very great deal about our covenant with Christ. Christ is the covenant head of his people. Very Christ-centered. And sola Deo gloria, to the glory of God alone, not for human glory. And that's what Oliver Cromwell was getting so upset about in that little clip we saw, because all of that was detracting, he felt, from the glory of God. All right. Got about just a few more minutes here tonight before we finish up our section tonight, but let's start on the English Reformation. And just try to understand this context here. Henry VIII and the Partial Reformation. Some of you may know the story of Henry VIII. Fascinating story. By the time it happens, Henry VIII is the overweight king with 8 wives. I would shudder to think to become a wife of Henry VIII, because after a while you wouldn't know how long you would last, because he found all kinds of ways to get rid of them, and several of them were actually executed, literally. And so I think it was 7 wives, actually. 7, I'm going by memory here. But Henry VIII first started the English Reformation because it was a way for him to get a divorce from his first wife, who he had grown to not like very well. He thought she was ugly, and she could not produce a male child for him. And she couldn't. She had a couple of children die in childbirth and had one daughter, Mary. So he didn't execute her, he just divorced her. He wanted a divorce from the Pope. And his archbishop, Cardinal Wolsey, had to work very hard. But he couldn't get a divorce. Now, under normal circumstances, popes in this period were easy if you just grease their palm a little bit to get, frankly, that's the bottom line. That's the only way to put it, because many of the popes were quite willing to do things like that if you grease their palms. Catholic historians will say the same thing. This is not a secret, that this was not exactly a high point of the Roman Catholic Church at this period. But the Pope at that time was heavily beholden to the Spanish king for political power. And guess what Henry's wife was the niece of? The Spanish king. And if you're the Pope and this English king wants to get a divorce, and you're beholden to Spanish power, the one thing you don't do is spit in the face of the Spanish king, so he kept hemming and hawing and never gave him the divorce. Finally, England got a new archbishop, a guy named Thomas Cranmer, He's an important figure in English history. Cranmer, Thomas Cranmer, who came up with a theological rationale, and it would have to do with the fact that his first wife had been married previously to his older brother who had died, and then they found something wrong with this to get Henry his divorce. So Henry declared himself an independent church in England. It really wasn't very Protestant. It was really almost like a Catholic church that had replaced the Pope with the head of the king as the head of the church. Everything else remained the same. I suspect in most of the little rural parish churches in England, most people had no clue that anything had happened. The same minister was up in front of them. Nothing had changed. However, Cranmer had been reading Luther and Zwingli and Bullinger and Oecklampadius and was gradually, he was a cautious man, but gradually becoming Protestant. Views. Gradually becoming Protestant and allowing Protestant teaching to come into England. Henry wasn't happy about this, but he was beholden to Cranmer because Cranmer had gotten him his divorce. And eventually, Cranmer himself married the niece of Martin Bucer, and I don't know if this is really true or not, but the rumors were that he actually carried her around in a traveled around England with her in a coffin as up with holes in the side so the king wouldn't know that he had married her because the king still wanted clerical celibacy. As I said, he still had it in his mind that this was going to be sort of a Catholic church without the Pope. The Protestant movement was slowly building, though. The problem was Henry went through all these wives and produced one male son, Edward VI. That one male son was a sickly young man. Nice young man, from all we know, but sickly. He died at age 16. Came to power at age 9. Well, one thing you know, you don't let 9-year-olds run the government. So they had a bunch of regents run the government. And some of them seemed to have been devout Protestants. Others were opportunists, we know that. But they had this surge of Protestantism. They invited Protestant theologians. Bucer came, and Peter Martyr Vermigli, and a few other Protestant theologians came to teach in Europe, in British universities. All of a sudden, they're getting serious Protestantism taught. Now, I was out in Yorkshire in a little parish church. They probably still don't know. Oh, yeah. Oh, another thing from the king. We don't know what's going on. It's the same guy still up in front. How much they affected the local churches yet, we don't know. But we do know that things are moving. But as I said, Edward VI died at age 16 after 7 years as king. That's not a long time for the Protestantism to take hold. His sister Mary comes to power. There was a little bit of a tussle, and they actually tried to get his cousin, Mary Jane Grey. And if you ever want to see a wonderful movie, there's a wonderful movie out there called Lady Jane Grey. And it's about Mary. She was like Queen of England for like 3 days or something like that. And it's a great example of the opportunists in the government, because there was this opportunist who married his son to Lady Jane Grey. He was one of the regents. And he thought, well, this is a good deal. Who doesn't want to marry your son to this queen? Well, then the people revolted, and they wouldn't accept a Lady Jane Grey. And they wanted Mary, because she was the legitimate queen. Well, Mary was a devout Catholic. She was the daughter of the deposed first wife. She had been tutored by Spanish priests and was a devout, devout Catholic. And her explicit goal was to turn England back into a Catholic country. Well, in this movie, there's this great scene because I think his name is Sir Dudley. He and another guy were talking, and they said, "Ooh, doesn't look like the people will accept Lady Jane Grey. What do we do now?" And he looks at him and he says, "I guess we learn to say Hail Mary, Queen of Grace." In other words, you go with the flow. You know, I was an opportunist. It looked like Protestantism was in the bandwagon, so I got my son married to Lady Jane Grey. But his son actually was this playboy who took all of a sudden was converted through the influence of his wife and took it seriously. They were both martyred. And there's this great scene in the movie where a Catholic priest comes and tries to deal with a lady. She's a 16-year-old teenage girl. And he says to her, tries to teach her about the Roman Catholic faith. And she's a very devout Protestant. And she finally looks at him and turns her head and says, "Sir, why do you worship a piece of bread? I worship Jesus Christ, not a piece of bread." In other words, she was a very devout Protestant. And she went to the gallows, had her head cut off. But Mary, Bloody Mary, takes over, turns the clock back. This is where we get the Marian exiles. Because what did Mary do? Mary decided that she was going to turn the clock back and make England Catholic again. And you had two options if you were a minister in England. Three options, really. You could renounce your Protestant faith, which England was technically a Protestant country, become a Roman Catholic again. You could be martyred. Many were. There were a number of people who were martyred. They would not renounce their Protestant faith. Or you could flee, which a number of did. The Marian exiles fled. And where did they go? Zurich, Geneva, Strasbourg, Emden, all towns where Reformed Christianity was practiced and practiced very, very strongly. One of them, and we'll finish up with this here tonight and just tell you this, one of them wrote back, I think it was John Knox, who was one of the Marian exiles, wrote back that when he went to Geneva, he thought Geneva, where Calvin was the most perfect school of Christ. In other words, he liked the place. This was the most perfect school of Christ. And he was saying, wow, this is what we've been wanting for years in England, and we haven't had it. These guys, these hundreds of ministers who fled, rather than getting the head cut off or having to become Roman Catholics, went into exile and drank deeply at the wells of Reformed centers. Mary would die in a few years. She had cancer. She didn't last long and would come back. And that's where we're going to pick up the story next week. But the Marian exiles will come back, and they will find an England that's technically will be reverting to Protestantism, but still has what you saw in Oliver Cromwell, the Oliver Cromwell clip, what they thought were elements of non-Protestant worship especially, and they got very agitated about it. And that is where Puritanism comes in. So we'll pick this up next week, and Kirk, you can stop the recording now with that. Thanks.